The Holy Gospel according to St. Luke, the 12th chapter. Someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." But Jesus said to him, "Friend, who set me to be a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take care. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. For one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." Then he told them a parable. The land of a rich man produced abundantly. And he thought to himself, "What should I do? For I have no place to store my crops." And then he said, "I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be?' So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich towards God." The Gospel of the Lord. So let's start with what many people in the congregation are talking about this week, and it's related to me. Yes, I got contacts. It's been amazing how much conversation I've had with people this week about my decision to go from my trifocals to contacts. But that has consumed a lot of conversation this week, so let's get it out in the open and own it so that we can name the elephant in the room and go on. I've had glasses since I was in sixth grade, and I have to admit that it is somewhat of a joy to not have to worry about putting those glasses on and keeping them from sliding down my nose throughout the day in this hot and humid weather. It is also refreshing, and please excuse the bad pun, to be able to see life through a whole different set of lenses. This is where you groan. Oh, okay, very good. Now we can move on. So what I'm asking you to do today is to take a look at the concept of reconciliation through a whole different set of lenses. During the month of July, we have looked at what we call the imaginary friends of the church, those items in which the church invests everything, thinking that's what makes the church work. We started with the notion of being in a Christian nation. We looked at culture wars. We looked at social justice. Today, we look at the imaginary friend of reconciliation. And I'm asking you to take a look at reconciliation in a whole new way. To take a look at reconciliation in a whole new way, I want to give you three examples of how I have heard people in the church, good Christian people, talk about forgiveness to others. The first happened on the evening of September 11th, 2001, and that was when the community in which I served gathered in Warren, Ohio for a prayer service after we had seen what happened in our nation that morning. Many denominations gathered together at Blessed Sacrament Church. We had a service of prayer, and the priest from that Roman church was the preacher. And in the sermon that night, the priest admonished the congregation, saying to them that no matter what they felt about what happened that morning, they needed to forgive those who had attacked us. I remember thinking even then it was way too soon to ask for people to forgive. We hadn't unpacked what had happened and what was behind it. And certainly forgiveness may come down the line, but it can be that Christians ask others to forgive too soon. Another case was a story told by Maria Maya Robbins, who was with us a number of years ago, PhD from Vanderbilt, that Professor Carey invited to join us. She told her own story of how she had a man break into her apartment and violate her and strip her and take her out to the front yard of her apartment building to let her for dead and vulnerable to the elements. And how, as she was in the hospital and the police were talking with her, one of her friends said to her, with all good Christian intent, said to her, "You're going to have to learn how to forgive the man who did this to you." And what she pointed out is she said, "How can I forgive the man who did this to me when we don't even know who it was yet?" And to this day, they haven't caught the man. So do we ask for forgiveness if the person doesn't have the chance to be held accountable for what they do wrong and to make it right? The third example of forgiveness happened much more recently. And that was about two Sundays ago, as I was taking our youth on their mission trip to Vermont. I shared with the congregation last week, a young man decided to run a stop sign, turning left, and hit our van head on, totaling both his car and our van. I am thankful that we all walked away uninjured at that point. But what happened was that young man kept approaching me after the accident, apologizing. And it got to the point that he kept getting in the way of me caring for our youth, which was my priority, so he could apologize to me again. And I realized that he was asking the people that he had injured to care for him by apologizing. Forgiveness is not asking the person you have wronged to care for you. And so as I think about those circumstances of forgiveness, I realize that many times forgiveness and reconciliation are so narrowly defined that the desire of reconciliation is that we can go back again to the way things were when they felt better. And that's not what reconciliation is. It's not going back again. That's the problem with the word again. We can't recreate the moment when things felt better. There is self-talk going on in the gospel text for today. I hope that you paid attention to it. I'm wondering how many of you here in the congregation this morning would be willing to admit that you talk to yourself. I will put my hand up. I even do that out loud at times. How many of you are even braver to admit that you answer yourself when you talk to yourself? I do that as well. There will be counselors available for you after the service today. I'm not only talking about that kind of self-talk, that out loud, like, "Where did I put my keys? Oh, they're in my hand, you stupid idiot. Why didn't you look there in the first place?" kind of self-talk. But I'm talking about the self-talk that goes on inside our heads. "I'm not good enough. Something wrong with me. I'm going to fail. It's all going to fall apart. I have to work harder, but I'm so tired." That kind of self-talk. And it's what's going on in this text today, that self-talk of this wealthy man who goes, "Self, look how much you have. Because you have it, you can sit back and relax and eat, drink, and be merry. But God talks to this man, and we hear that night that God isn't nearly as respectful to the man as the man is to himself. God says, "You fool. Tonight, your very life is demanded of you, and all of those things on which you have been relying, that you have accumulated, all of your possessions, they will do nothing for you. That you are at the mercy of God at this moment." So before television came up with the series on hoarders, the Bible had a hoarder, and it was this rich man. Now, I've encountered hoarders in a couple of different situations. One hoarder is the kind of person who is afraid of that day when everything is going to fall apart. And Pastor Tasha, because you are more hip than me, gave me the proper term for it, which is doomsday preppers. And this man is preparing for doomsday. And the way he does that is that he continues to buy canned food. You can't put anything under any piece of furniture in his house because it is stacked full of canned food. The pantry is stacked full. The linen closets are stacked full. Everywhere it's filled with food because he's afraid if something happens, he won't have enough. Now, there's another kind of hoarder that I've encountered, and this was the kind of person that didn't keep up with taking care of her house. And so you could go to the house and you would see just stacks of dishes dirty on the counter, the kind where you wouldn't even know where to start to wash the dishes. And they did one of two things in that family. Either they started to eat off of paper plates because they didn't have any clean dishes, or they would go out and buy more dishes because they didn't wash what they had. In her case, her fear was that she wouldn't be able to tackle the project because it was too much and she wouldn't do it good enough. And because she wouldn't be able to do it the way she thought she should do it, she shut herself down and couldn't do it at all. And the third type of hoarder that I saw just a couple weeks ago on our mission trip, and I'd never noticed this before, but this was a person who had a vision for what she wanted her life to be. And she started accumulating things so that she could get there, but just didn't have what it took to get from having the things to making it happen. And so on her porch were just stacks of seeds and plants and pots and potting soil because she wanted a garden, but she didn't have any idea how to plant a garden and take care of a garden. So what we did is we put a garden in for her and taught her how to take care of the garden. But she just didn't have what it took to get from the stuff to the garden. It's that fear of not having enough, not having what it takes to make things work. So what is your fear of running out of something? You know, Brené Brown in her book, Daring Greatly, says, is it that you're never good enough, you're never perfect enough, never thin enough, never powerful enough or successful enough, that you are never smart enough or extraordinary enough, never safe enough? What is it that you're never enough of? And the way that you can get at that is to ask yourself the question, How would I answer this? If only I had more of, my life would be better. Whatever you put in that blank, that answer is your God. Whatever we think we have need more of will become our God. And it becomes our idol. Everything in which we invest ourselves in order to get through will eventually let us down. Our possessions, our reputations, our techniques for living, our systems for understanding life, none of them will help us conquer death, because they will die with us, and someone else will get it all. When you're facing down your God, will that God show you mercy? There is only one who will. There's only one God that will show you mercy at the time of your death, and that's the one who has the capacity to conquer death. That's the God that we see through Jesus Christ, who, even though we have wandered and strayed so many times, shows us mercy and forgiveness and reconciles us with God so that we can have eternal life. As Richard Lisher puts in his book, The End of Words, which is about reconciliation, he says, once you have seen the face of God and received God's mercy, it's then that you have the capacity to also see the faces of your brothers and sisters and show mercy to them as well. That's what makes reconciliation possible. As Paul writes in 2 Corinthians, as we were first reconciled with God through Christ, we can now be reconciled with one another. We live in a culture of what one writer calls the enemy other, the other as enemy, that we see other people who are different than us, those who disagree with us, as our enemies. We're afraid of the enemy other. And what fear does is fear allows room for anger. It's fascinating to me that there is this core group in our nation that I, ballparking, are men, white males from about 50, 55 to 75, who are extraordinarily angry men. And they're angry because they have seen everything that used to work for them as white males falling away from them. And in that anger and in that fear, they are willing to buy into any solution that might come along that will put them back in power. And I'm afraid that has become the base of the extreme conservative part of our political system. You see, it's easier to be angry than it is to trust someone else. remember one time in working with a couple where there had been an affair, the husband had said to me after the wife was remarkably forgiving, it would be easier if she stayed angry with me. It's scarier that she forgives me because I have to trust her. It takes more risk to trust somebody than it does to stay angry at them. Unfortunately, what we don't take time to do is to grasp that while we have seen something that has happened and we have drawn a moral conclusion about it and put good explanations with it, we're not aware that some emotional process has been in between. Within that nanosecond of what we've seen and the conclusion we draw, something else has happened inside of us emotionally. It came into play when my wife and I were picking names for my son. And I'm going to use an example of the name Elmer because that was one of the names that came up. If Elmer is in your name or if you know someone named Elmer, I'm not putting the name down. I'm just sharing what went through our minds. My wife said, what about the name Elmer? Because it was in her family line. And I said no, because as soon as I think of Elmer, I think that our son will be put down because people will think of Elmer Fudd. And I don't want people to think of him as Elmer Fudd. And because he's going to be biracial and have other things working against him, you notice how we can construct those moral arguments. But once I thought about it, I realized the reason I had trouble with the name Elmer wasn't because it was a moral issue, but it's because I remembered in third grade a kid named Elmer in my class who always sat next to me and for whatever reason drank grape Kool-Aid before he came to school. And when he talked to me in the morning, he would look at me, he would get too close, and I could always smell that grape Kool-Aid on his breath. And I don't like grape Kool-Aid. It wasn't a moral decision at all. It was an emotional decision that happened so quickly, I didn't even realize at first that it happened. And we do that about people on a regular basis. As Christians, there is no longer a distinction between us. And we have this false distinction of liberal Christian or conservative Christian. I don't think you can use those terms faithfully. What we've done is we have put political ideology over top of our Christian faith. What does Paul write in Colossians? There is no longer a distinction between us. That what unites us is not a political ideology, but that we all belong to Christ. And as those who belong to Christ, we all have the same Lord and the same God. It's the only label we can use that applies to everybody. So we can't put distinctions on that. As those then who are God's people, we no longer make a distinction between others other than that they are also children of God, then we can engage one another in a new way. As one author calls it, affirmative inquiry. To be confident of who we are, but also be willing to fully engage another person and find out who they are. It's possible to do both without judging and violating the integrity of the person who's different than us. And that's where my critique of liberalism stands right now, because they perceive themselves in power, is that they don't allow room for inquiry. As soon as you dare ask a question, you are diminished by being phobic or something wrong with you. Affirmative inquiry allows a person to claim who they are and at the same time to engage and learn about the other person. That's what reconciliation can look like in this time. It's not about, again, we can't recreate the church to what it used to look like in the 50s and the 60s because the Christian faith in the church no longer holds a prominent place in our culture. We have an extraordinarily religious, diverse nation of people of different races. We are in a very different place as the church. The question becomes, what is our relationship with all of these other cultures out there around us? And I think what we have to contribute is this gift of reconciliation that honors the integrity of each and every person. And that reconciliation, brothers and sisters, is not something that I can do. You recognize those words? I can do it. It's also not something we can do together. Do you recognize those words? It's not possible either. It is only possible when God makes it work. And that's what we believe as the church. Amen.